Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Let's turn in our Bibles to Acts chapter 23. The plan for today, see how far we get, is to finish up the section on Paul's arrest in Jerusalem and hopefully get to a good stopping point so that when we pick it up in a couple weeks, Mr. Simpson will be able to get a good interjectory lesson in there, and then we'll pick it up here in a couple weeks. So, as a reminder, I'm gone next week. So, all righty, there it is. Okay. So, Acts chapter 23. The events leading up to this, of course, are that Paul has arrived in Jerusalem. He has been, well, he's been arrested. He's been taken control of by the Roman commanders, commander specifically. And where we're going to pick it up today here is, we'll pick it up here in verse 11. We'll see how far we get. My goal is to get through quite a bit of this, but I guess, again, we'll see. But we'll pick it up here in verse 11, and we'll just read down through verse 22, and then we'll get rolling. So Acts 23, verse 11. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must also witness at Rome also." When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now therefore you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place." But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him." So he took him and led him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you." The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, "What is it that you have to report to me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready for and waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, "Tell no one that you have notified me of these things." All right. So Paul, by this point, he has had the opportunity to speak to the Jewish mob that doesn't like what he's saying. And because of the violence against him, the commander is taking him into the barracks, basically taking him away from the situation. And so that night, while Paul is contemplating his particular situation, the Lord appears to him and reassures him that he would bear witness in Rome. Now, if you think back to what Paul had been warned about what would happen to him, that very thing had occurred. So if you go back to Acts chapter 21, just for the sake of reminder here, remember when Paul was traveling, just to give you a quick example here from Acts chapter 21, verse 10, this is, of course, when Paul is on his way from Miletus, and he says, "As we were staying there for some days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea, and coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands and said, 'This is what the Holy Spirit says. In this way, the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns the belt and deliver him into the hand of the Gentiles.'" So, got a question for you. Was it the Jews who actually bound him? No. Okay. Who killed Jesus? The Romans. You see a pattern here? It's not, I mean, the Jews are ultimately the ones who were responsible for the crucifixion of Christ, right? But they used the Roman army and the Roman law in order to bring these things about. So in this case, we can see that the very thing that Paul had been warned about had happened. He was bound and imprisoned. Now, while it wasn't the Jews specifically who had bound him, who had, you know, physically put the restraints on him and drug him off to go into captivity, they made it happen through the Roman law. So he had been rescued by the Jewish mob from the Roman commander, and at this point, Paul is encouraged here to keep his head up, you know, to not lose hope. Let's go back to 22. We'll start here in verse 17. Remember, this is where Paul is speaking to the Jewish mob, and he mentions something here in verse 18, but verse 17, it says, "It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.'" So Paul is, he's been told, this is, of course, way back in the beginning of Paul's ministry. He was told by the Lord that they weren't going to listen. And they didn't at the time either. And so that begins Paul's missionary journeys. And he comes back to Jerusalem and essentially finds the same reception. They are not willing to listen. So here in verse 11, there's a couple of things I want to point out here in chapter 23. He says, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem." If you look up that solemnly witnessed, it's actually kind of interesting. It's a long Greek word. I'm not even going to try to slaughter it. But it's Strong's G, 1263. It's best translated as, "You have fully testified." So I find that interesting because Paul, in his effort to reach the people in Jerusalem, the Lord tells him, "You have done everything I have asked you to do. You have fully testified to my cause at Jerusalem." Paul had fulfilled the Lord's purpose. Paul went on his missionary journeys, and he was returning to Jerusalem with the point of trying to preach the gospel. But, as we know, they didn't want to hear it. They didn't receive him well. So the conversation shifts a little, and he says, "So you must witness at Rome also." This was the very thing that Paul wanted to do, and the very thing that he had asked for prayers in reference to. So let's check out a couple of those. Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, we'll just start in verse 8. He says, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world. For God, whom I serve in my spirit in the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you, always in my prayers, making request, if perhaps now at last, by the will of God, I may succeed in coming to you." So Paul had asked for prayers and basically had been praying for the opportunity to get to Rome. Same book, but obviously a few chapters later, 15. Let's go over to Romans chapter 15. He ends I wrote down the wrong verse. Well, point is he wants to get to Rome. I don't even have the right reference here. I have like 32. Like, what? There's not even 32 verses in Romans. What's that? Oh, yeah. Thank you. I don't want to read that whole section. Let's start in 22, and we'll just go down through verse 25. He says, "For this reason I have often been prevented from coming to you, but now, with no further place for me in these regions, and since I have had for many years a longing to come to you, whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing and to be helped on in my way there by you when I have first enjoyed your company for a while. But now I am going to Jerusalem serving the saints." So Paul's desire was to go to Rome on his way to Spain. So Paul, of course, had a bigger picture in mind than simply going on to Jerusalem and staying there. Of course, getting the opportunity to go to Rome, this was probably and obviously not the way that Paul had considered he would get there. He wasn't really envisioning that he would go in chains under Roman control. Or maybe he was. We don't know how much he had been told. But the point was is that he was going to get to Rome, and he was going to get the opportunity to address the Gentiles. Remember what the warning had been given to him by Agabus, that he would be handed over to the Gentiles, and this is exactly what had happened. You know, in a lot of ways, you consider the cost of travel at the time. How had he covered his expenses up to this point? Okay, he had made some tents. But for the most part, the church supported him. He got from place to place to place from essentially the church helping him along his way. And now he's going to get the opportunity to travel to Rome, which is a pretty good distance, but the church isn't going to have to foot the bill. The Romans are going to do it. So, hey, you know what? Why not take the opportunity? So, at this point, we see here in Acts chapter 23, verse 12, that there's this, these 40 Jews, they bind themselves under an oath to kill Paul. And then, these 40 guys, they go to the council, and they form a plot with the council, the chief priests, and the elders, to bring Paul out so that they have an opportunity to kill him. Now, the reason, of course, that the elders and the council are interested in this plot, is because, guess what? They get what they want without blood on their hands, quote, you know, so to say. They're not, we didn't kill, it was these 40, we had nothing, it was just these 40 guys that did this, not us. We had nothing to do with it. But they see an opportunity there, because, of course, Paul is in Roman hands, and he's escaping the council's version of justice. And so these men, these 40 who had bound themselves in a plot, are provoked to murderous hatred over Paul. The solemn oath here is rather interesting. Strong's numbers are G331 and 332, under which they bound themselves. Literally, it means they placed themselves under an anathema. You know what anathema means? Is it a good thing? No. It's not a good thing. You'll see this word translated in a few other ways, but this was a reference to the Jewish term cherem, and the person or thing on which this anathema fell was regarded as being devoted to the wrath of God. Okay, so they basically called upon themselves the worst possible curse they could give themselves if they didn't complete what it was that they were setting out to do. Okay? Paul uses the Greek form of this cherem, which is this word that means anathema, in a couple of different forms. And I want you to see this because these guys were very serious about this. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. First Corinthians chapter 16, verse 22, Paul's wrapping up his letter. He says, if anyone does not love the Lord, he is to be accursed. That's that Greek word. That's the Greek word form of the Jewish word. Okay? That's not a great place to be. How about Galatians chapter 1? We'll start here in verse 6, but you'll see this word being used a couple of times in verses 8 and 9. He says, I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another, only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. As we have said before, so I say again now, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, he is to be accursed. So, not exactly a way to, in my opinion, to be pleasing to the Lord. To try to make yourself accursed unless you fulfill this task that you've set before yourself, which is killing an innocent man. Okay? So, in the Old Testament, we find that this same word in Jericho, it's used in description of the events in Jericho. You remember what happened in Jericho? Remember what they were told? Joshua chapter 7. Mr. Simpson preached a great message on this one years ago. Achan's taken heart. Right? Everything that was in Jericho, they could just go through and pick up whatever they wanted. Oh, hey, there's some silver on the ground here. I'll take that, put that in my pocket, maybe a couple of nice swords and a shield or two. No, it was accursed. It was under the ban. You don't take it, don't touch it, leave it alone. And of course, we know what happened in Joshua chapter 7 with Achan, but we won't go there for the sake of time. But these men had made a vow that if not fulfilled, it would find them accursed of the Lord. They put themselves in that situation. The willingness of these men to take such a vow illustrates the reprobate state of the Jewish religion by this time. And the fact that the council supported it is even worse. These were the very people who were supposed to be keeping the law. These were the very people who were supposed to be teaching the people to keep the law and to be pleasing to the Lord. Yet they had drifted so far away from any semblance of adherence to the law that they were now encouraging somebody to kill somebody else under a curse of anathema. Paul writes actually something very much similar to this in a couple letters that will follow these events. Let's go over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. Of course, we know 2 Timothy was written much later than these particular events. But I found it interesting in thinking through this, how Paul mentions something that very much describes the events that are going on here. In chapter 3, we'll just start in verse 1. But realize this, that in the last days difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power. Avoid such men as these. I find it rather interesting that this is exactly what the council was doing. They're the ones who are walking around with the robes and making themselves out to be somebody important, but they had denied the very power that was behind what they were trying to preach. They had denied the righteousness that God had supplied in, well, the opportunity to be righteous, if you will, through the law. Colossians chapter 2, again, this letter is written after these events. Just for the sake of time, we'll get verse 23. He says, these are matters which have to be sure the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. You know, I know that these aren't, you can't make that direct connection, but I just find it interesting that I think events like this had an effect on the way that Paul would write and the things that he would cover. There's a close and a rather strange alliance between formal religion and murderous hatred. When you have this perspective that these 40 men are willing to be anathema to the Lord to kill an innocent man, and they have the support of the council, it indicates just how far away from righteousness they had fallen. And now let's put yourself in the situation of these 40 guys. Paul is under the control and protection of the Roman army. And you're going to bust him out, and you're going to kill him. So they try to find an opportunity. You know, 40 guys gathered together, you think that's a lot. It's a fair number. But keep in mind how many soldiers were in Jerusalem at this particular time. And we'll see the response that the commander has to this particular event, and we'll actually, you know, talk about some of the math there, but these guys must have been pretty committed to this. Paul was under the control of the empire, and it would be no small feat to not only get to him, but to kill him. Because remember, what was it that had precipitated all of this? What caused Paul's arrest in Jerusalem? Do you remember? He was playing tiddlywinks on the wrong board, right? The Asiarchs, the Jews from Asia, accused him of a bunch of stuff, and then a mob starts, and then the Romans think, hey, we got somebody here. Remember who they thought he was? The Egyptian? Remember that? The Egyptian false prophet? So this is one of the reasons why Paul gets arrested, and they're like, wait a minute, who is this guy? And then they figure out that nobody knows what's going on, and so they take control of him. And again, I've mentioned this a few times, but it just blows me away that these men brought this vow to the chief priests and the elders who don't condemn their actions. They condone them. And, of course, they agree to support them in their murderous desires. Yep, sure, we'll do that. Sounds good to us. It blows me away. But Paul's nephew, he hears the plot, and he basically brings it to the commander's attention. We read those verses, but in 16 through 22 there. And just as a side note, this is the only reference to Paul's direct family in the scriptures. We know that Paul wasn't married, but there's no mention of any other physical siblings. There's no mention of his parents or anything like that. This is the only direct reference to Paul's family in the scriptures. So Paul's sister's son or his nephew. A couple of reasons why he could have been there, we don't really know. Here's a few things that I just had kind of worked through. He may have lived in Jerusalem with his mother. That's unlikely, in my opinion, as Paul was not from Jerusalem, and he also didn't stay with her when he came to Jerusalem. So if she lived there, it's kind of it wouldn't make sense that she was there if he didn't stay with her. He also could have been there as part of his formal education, as Paul had been. Remember, Paul had spent quite a bit of time in Jerusalem being educated under Gamaliel, right? So, could be the reason why he was there. He and his mother, Paul's sister, also may have been part of the church, and they were in Jerusalem to take part in the festivals. It's really difficult to say with any certainty. Don't really know why, but the Lord uses people and puts them in the right place at the right time. So he hears of the plot. Okay, so you have 40 guys who have not very happy with the events that have occurred, that Paul has escaped the justice of the council. They form themselves a plot, and then they go to the chief priests and the elders, and they're like, okay, this is what we want to do. And the chief priests and the elders are like, yep, you got the big thumbs up from us. It would be kind of tough to keep that under wraps. Unless they all stayed together in the same room and didn't talk to anybody else. But how Paul's nephew heard of this, we don't really know. Doesn't give us a lot of detail. But trying to keep this quiet amongst this group of men who were probably, psyching themselves up to do this, it would have been tough. So Paul hears about it. Paul's nephew hears about it, and they bring it to Paul. And this illustrates a couple of other things here in the section that we covered, is that Paul was able to have visitors and speak freely with the soldiers. It wasn't like Paul was, stuffed in a dungeon like he had been in Philippi, but he had the ability to speak freely with visitors and to a certain extent, and of course, speak with the Roman soldiers. And as a Roman citizen, this is where it's really helpful for Paul, obviously, as a Roman citizen and with no charges officially brought against him, It's probable that he was not closely confined. And again, you have this mob of people who's trying to kill this guy. He's a Roman citizen, and as a Roman, your job was to keep the peace. So the best way to keep the peace in this particular situation was to keep this guy from getting killed. Okay? So Paul's nephew tells the commander, Claudius, of the plot, and then at this point the Roman commander prepares an armed guard and a letter to accompany Paul to Felix, the governor, in Caesarea. So let's go ahead and jump here into verse 23. We'll just read down through the end of the chapter here. It says, and he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and to bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor, Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So, the Roman commander hears about this, and he gets together 470 men between the horsemen and the folks on the walking soldiers and those who bear the spear. That very hour of the night, about 9 o'clock, third hour of the day, if they're assuming that Luke is using Jewish time, about 9 o'clock that night, writes a letter and sends him off to Felix, describing the conditions under which he was sent. 470 soldiers against 40, you know, starving Jewish guys, there's really not much of a chance of the Jewish guys winning in this particular point, and they probably figured it out. So, what happened to these guys? Did they all starve to death? Do you ever think about that? I think they're just, you know, oh, shoot. Guess we're... yeah. 470 Roman soldiers and Paul on a horse. Yeah. So what do you think happened to these guys? These 40 guys who had decided that they weren't going to eat or drink until they killed Paul. You know that under the Jewish law, not the Jewish law, excuse me, under the Jewish tradition, if you made such a vow like that, all you'd have to do is go back to the rabbi and say, oops. I'm sure there was more involved than just saying, oops. But they probably went back to the Jewish rabbi, probably the same guys in the council, and said, we need absolution from this vow. And they were probably willing to do it. I just find it interesting that these guys were so willing to do it, and then there's no evidence that they, of course, knew that Paul had left, which, again, if you're keeping an eye on somebody and you're waiting to kill him, and then he leaves with 500 people, soldiers, pretty good idea you're going to notice him leaving. So, at any rate, I just find it funny that there's no mention of him, of course. We don't know what happened exactly. I'm sure they didn't starve to death. I'm sure they probably decided, well, we tried, and went and had dinner. So, at any rate, the letter, of course, here, he outlines the reason why Paul's appearance before is being sent to Felix in the first place. And you have to appreciate Claudius's approach to this. He's like, I don't really know what's going on here. I don't know why these guys are so upset. It's over something about the law, but I don't really see it as a reason for having him put to death or anything like that. So I appreciate Claudius's straightforward approach to delivering Paul to Felix. Of course, that's a whole other story in and of itself, and we'll chat a little bit about Felix as we get to that point. But Paul safely arrives in Caesarea, and he's presented to the governor there in verses 31 and 33. Now, accompanied by the soldiers and horsemen, Paul leaves Jerusalem, and they arrive in Antipatris, or Patras, which is about 30 miles north, on the next day. So it takes him about a day, well, it takes him overnight, to arrive in the city, traveling about 30 miles. Just as I've been covering as we go through this, Antipatris was a city that was built during the first century BC, by Herod the Great, who named it in honor of his father. And then Caesarea was about 30, 35 miles north of Antipatris. It was about 65 miles from Jerusalem. And if they had continued on foot, it would have taken 2 to 3 days, possibly longer with such a large contingent of soldiers. But point is that Paul arrives in Antipatris about halfway. They stay, everybody else leaves, the horsemen then go on to Caesarea. So, Felix reads the letter, and he learns that Paul was from Cilicia, and dealing with Felix is a rather interesting event that in Paul's life, I think, but he basically promises to grant Paul an audience when his accusers had come. So if you remember, although we don't have it recorded exactly what Claudius had said, he wrote in his letter to Felix that he told his accusers that they needed to go to Caesarea and meet Felix and then levy their charges against him. Okay? So remember we talked about this, I think it was last week, about sometimes how presenting your case before a Caesar is sometimes dangerous to your health. Yeah, I don't know if that was part of the reason why Claudius did it, like, hey, you got to go up here and talk to a governor here, you know, you got to talk to the higher up guy, maybe just to dissuade them. I don't know, other than following, of course, the law, or the Roman law. It's just interesting to think about. So he commands then that Paul be kept in Herod's Praetorium. Now, Herod's Praetorium, or the Praetorium in Caesarea, it was on the coastline and at the south end of the Hippodrome. If you look into any biblical archaeology and you see the Roman cities that were built, the Hippodromes were basically big open-air theaters, much like the one that he would have, say, been in Ephesus, or you know, you think of the Colosseum in Rome, not quite that spectacular, but these large open-air theaters where things like chariot races and other competitive events would occur, Olympics and things like that would occur in these things. Now, why is this important? Well, because they basically where Paul would have been housed in the Praetorium would have been on the east side of the Praetorium at the south end of the Hippodrome. So he would have been hearing all of these events occurring outside. And as we'll talk about when I come back in a couple weeks, you know, Paul spent 2 years in that area, in the Praetorium, as essentially a prisoner, and Felix had his own reasons for doing it. But he stayed there for the next 2 years, and while he wasn't a free man, he certainly wasn't 100% you know, confined, but he wouldn't have had much of an opportunity to really get out and speak to people. So for somebody like Paul, who had spent the last several years of his life, the last you know, multiple years of his life, traveling and speaking to people about the gospel and having taking opportunities to speak to large groups of people, to see all these people, or to hear all these people gathered in the Hippodrome and around the city, it must have driven him nuts. So he, of course, invests some time in writing, which we'll talk about next time. So a couple of things here. You know, remember why Paul had wanted to go to Jerusalem? Anybody? What was it that was trying? Why was he trying to get to Jerusalem? Super Dave? Pentecost. Okay, he wanted to be there for Pentecost. Why? Yeah, because he could speak to the Jews. There's a great collection of people there, right? We talked a little bit about with Jesus and his opportunity to speak to the multitudes that were there. And when he was there in his ministry, and then, it just happens to work out that Acts chapter 2 falls on the day of Pentecost. Huh. So there's this great opportunity, and it must have been a little disappointing because he'd been in Jerusalem for about a week. that didn't last long. He was likely sent away before the day of Pentecost. We don't have any record of him being able to partake in those festivities. But the Lord had given him a lot of reason to rejoice because he was going to go to Rome. He was going to have the opportunity to speak to the powers that be in the imperial world anyway. Now, I know it's difficult for us, I think, sometimes to put ourselves in that situation, but imagine if you were the Apostle Paul and you'd spent most of your time speaking to all these little towns and some of the larger towns and speaking to the big wigs in education and so on and so forth, and now you're getting the opportunity to speak to Caesar. You're going to be sent to Rome with the opportunity to speak to the most powerful man in the world. I think that would be pretty exciting. So, on one hand, while he didn't have much of an opportunity with the Jews to speak, which, you know, Paul had certainly taken his opportunities, taken his shots, it might have been a little disappointing in that regard, but he wanted to go and speak to the Gentiles. He wanted to go to Rome, as we talked about. And it was something, as we had already talked about as well, that he'd asked the brethren to pray for. The Lord had certainly answered the first part of his request. Deliverance from those in Judea who did not believe. Remember Romans chapter 15. And he would answer the second part of that prayer, that he would be able to get to Rome. Yet, as we'll see, not as soon or quite in the manner that Paul might have expected. Paul doesn't just jump on a bus or on a plane and fly to Rome. I mean, as we'll talk about, there's obviously several chapters left in this book. The travel to Rome was fraught with its own peril and opportunities. What I want you to see out of this particular section with Paul's arrest in Jerusalem, so you think about all the things that had led up to this. You think about all the times that he had been talked to by the prophets, and the prophets telling him, this is a bad idea, don't go. Think about the opportunities that Paul had along the way. Think about what he was trying to accomplish when he's in Jerusalem. And all of that seemed to fall flat. He didn't have the opportunity to speak to the Jews as much as he would have liked. But from all of that that didn't work out, Paul ended up with an opportunity that, really, I don't think a lot of us would ever really have. I mean, I used to joke that, I think it was President Clinton at the time. I used to joke that I'd like to talk to President Clinton and preach the gospel to him. I don't think he'd listen, and I don't think that I would get the opportunity to do such. But Paul is in the situation to be able to speak to some of the most important people in the world. And he did not take that opportunity lightly, as we'll see. Super Dave, you had a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it is very encouraging to read this about Paul, knowing the fact that it didn't matter what affliction he was going up against, he knew. Mm-hmm. He, in a way, looked forward to it because then he could reach people he would not otherwise been able to reach. Right. And he took every opportunity there was, even when they got stranded on the island, to speak to the natives of the island, getting bit by the viper and shaking it off. It opened up doors for him, and he took every opportunity he could. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, it is. And through this, too, you notice that Christianity wasn't something that Paul did. It's who he was, and you see that all the way through this.
It really stimulated my mind this morning and thinking about the questions you asked about the Pharisees, the council, and the plot, and the curse they put themselves under. You have to remember that Jesus had accused the Pharisees of taking the seat of Moses, placing themselves there. And, of course, historically, they're looked to for a lot of the answers in the law. And even further back on the deportation of Babylon, that's where the Talmudic, if that's how you pronounce it correctly, tradition happened, which basically isn't law. It's a law based on precedence. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have the mess we had. But thinking about that for a second, when you were talking up there, I was thinking about how Claudius really took him out of one jurisdiction to another jurisdiction, mm-hmm. on who the recognized authority was. And so you may say that we don't have an opportunity, but I think we are living right now in time at an opportunity. I have European friends who some in the church, some not, that are giving me information that they're basing it on Austrian model right now on QR codes. It's that little square that looks weird. Mm-hmm. For a passport, it had come across a YouTube describing this new software that takes care of everything for you when you're authorized. So right now, we're drifting from our republic long time ago. It's been a slow burn into this new medical tyranny, if you would, and authorization. And so right now, it kind of looks like a bloodless revolution that's kind of happening right now, but it could turn hot, and it may in America, you know, based on things. There's been material written in the past about the balkanization of the United States. So if you've ever had any history or, you know, any of those things that happened in the Balkans, it can get pretty ugly when lawlessness occurs and people are looking for normalcy. I get to go to the grocery store, I get to get my milk, I get to go downtown to the theater, whatever it is that occurring in daily life. And all of this stems out of this, I would say, rabid dog feeling to stomp out Christianity from the very beginning, because it's followed it everywhere. And when you look at Revelations and you start thinking about some of the weird pictures you're getting about this Armageddon fight that's going to happen, you know, maybe they really don't need half of us, because they've instituted AI and the robots that we can't see, just like something out of Star Wars on the Clone Wars. I mean, if you really think about it, they're trying to, even in trucking industry, in the mining operations, you can have these big trucks that are run with no operators. Yeah. They may not have, you know, a torturous path up Pike's Peak or something like that. They're just going from the scoop to the rail line or whatever trolley that they're loading coal on. But you have to really take a pause and think for a second. If someone is going to interrupt production so much, they've got to have an understanding that they've got enough resources that we don't have, and or that the dream is over and we got a new reality coming in, and or they can actually physically replace us for some tasks that are manual labor. So it's really always has been kind of a struggle between management and labor. And so when, you know, James talks about the guys that are, you know, withholding the wages from the guys that mold your field, this is not new. It's just brought up to a new level. And so this tyranny that we're experiencing right now is actually an opportunity for us to refocus and look, even though they're trying to separate us, and look for the opportunity someone wants to know about Christianity and the truth and what's real, and not this singularity they're pushing where we're going to join ourselves with machines. And this is the old argument about the ghost in the shell type thing. Well, God did that, and they're trying to place themselves in the point of God by eliminating God. Yep. So we got to be very, very careful about what we're thinking about our current landscape, and to remember the mission, to keep continually pushing forward and forgetting what lies behind and renewing our minds, because there is a full court press that's happening right now.
Yeah, actually, it's good comments, Mark. I'm glad you brought it back around to the final point. But the reality is that the situation we find ourselves in today is not new. It's been repeated throughout history in one way, shape, or form. Just today, it has a different veneer to it. And actually, another brother and I were talking about this morning. You know, we don't. You read details about what the first century Christians, second century Christians, had lived through, and the things that they had to do in order to get together. They made a priority of getting together. They met in the catacombs, guys. They did what they needed to do. They risked their own lives to simply see one another. So I guess the point is we can ask ourselves, what is it that's going to keep us from getting together? A little bit of snow? Hope not. So anyway, we'll go ahead and wrap up there today. Thank you for your kind attention. And then next week, Mr. Simpson will be bringing you something, and then we'll pick it up in a couple weeks. Thank you.